please. Oyez. All persons having business with the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please.
May it please the court, Shannon Coffin for defendant David Safavian. I'd like to save a minute for rebuttal. After this court reversed Mr. Safavian's convictions for fraudulent concealment and remanded the remainder of his case for a retrial, the prosecutors upped the ante by adding two new charges in what can only be viewed as an effort to punish Mr. Safavian for taking his appeal. This court should once again throw out his convictions.
If you viewed only that way, Judge Friedman didn't view it that way.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I believe Judge Friedman was mistaken. And I believe that his decision meets the clearly erroneous standard set by this court in Meyer. I'll turn to the vindictive prosecution charge first, Your Honor. The district court correctly held that this is an appropriate case for the presumption of vindictiveness to apply, and that's because all the hallmarks of a realistic likelihood of vindictiveness are presented in this case. First, it's post-appeal. As Blackledge says, increasing the charges post-appeal amounts to a reason to apply an automatic reason to apply the presumption of vindictiveness. There's an increased risk of a longer sentence in this case. As we say in our reply brief, it goes from 12 to 18 months under the guidelines to 15 to 21 months. And it arises, although this is not dispositive, it's certainly helpful, it arises from the same nucleus of operative fact. Turning to the government's justifications for the new charges, I'll first look at the fifth charge, where they say that trial strategy is their reason for bringing the charge of misstatements to the FBI. Respectfully, that trial strategy justification is entirely pretextual. First, the justification must be based on objective evidence. And here, ultimately, what you have is the subjective trial strategy of a prosecutor. We submit that subjective trial strategy can never be a justification under the burden-shifting standard of vindictive prosecution, but in this particular case, ultimately, what it boils down to is the prosecutors had an unfounded fear of exclusion of the evidence, and that evidence actually got in. Some of that evidence actually got in at the first trial. The trials.
I'm sorry, what evidence is it?
Your Honor, it's the evidence of the misstatements made to the FBI agent. The trial strategy here, according to the government, is we have to charge those misstatements, even though we had all that evidence before. We have to charge here because there was a change in our trial strategy on remand, and
wasn't the change occasioned by the court's holding on concealment?
Oh, I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, I think first of all there was no change in trial strategy from the first trial. They knew 4 months before the first trial that we were going to use literal truth as a defense. In our January 2006 pretrial motion, we said that literal truth was our major defense, They also knew before trial that we were going to put in expert testimony. All this court's decision did was affirm that we could. So there were no change in expectations from one trial to the next. Most importantly, that trial strategy justification has absolutely nothing to do with the one specification that we were actually, that Mr. Safavian was actually convicted of, that he couldn't help if he wanted to. The government concedes and the district court conceded that that particular specification, which is the only specification on count five that Mr. Safavian was actually convicted of, was completely unrelated to the trial strategy justification. But the district court said essentially close enough, that it was in the same conversation. So there's a daisy chain of connectedness here that certainly can't satisfy the government's requirement that it base its determination on objective evidence. On count three, which deals with the misstatements about the value of the trip, the government says there's new evidence, but that new evidence is entirely cumulative of what was in the first trial. And, Your Honor, in the first trial, they actually charged Mr. Safavian with obstruction based on the very same misstatement. This court, in reviewing the record after the first trial, held that the evidence at the first trial was sufficient to convict on that misstatement. So the government now says we have new evidence, but that new evidence is entirely related to what it already, A, knew before the first trial, and B, charged Mr. Safavian with in the first trial. Respectfully, Your Honor.
You said they're new witnesses, though, with respect to the count three, right?
That's right. They were new witnesses, but again, this court had already held that there was sufficient evidence to convict on the very same misstatement in count one, the obstruction count in the first trial. This case is a lot like the Ninth Circuit's decision in United States versus Jenkins, which we cite in our brief. There was a case where there was a misstatement. There was a defense at trial where a defendant said the reason she was not guilty of knowingly importing drugs over the border from Mexico was that she had actually made this trip over the border a couple of times, and the previous two times she'd been smuggling aliens. Well, the government then moved to indict her on alien smuggling charges, and the court said, well, hold on. You already had all the evidence that you needed to indict her on alien smuggling charges because she'd made the very same statement to police prior to trial. Here, we're even one step further removed from that, in that the government not only had the evidence to charge on a misstatement about the cost of the trip, it actually did charge. And once it exercises its discretion after that, in that first indictment, once it makes a prosecutorial exercise of discretion, any change to that later can only be viewed as vindictive. Your Honor, yes, Your Honor.
I was just going to ask whether you think the court's remand was itself an objective fact.
I don't think so. I think the court's remand can be the reason. Well, I don't think the court's remand can be the reason for reviewing for changing strategy. There's actually a district court decision that actually held that a district court in Maine in a recent case basically said that it may be the occasion for reconsidering strategy, but it can't be the justification, because that in and of itself suggests that the purposes for the vindictive prosecution doctrine are actually motivating the government. I'd like to turn briefly, if I can.
Why is that? Suppose the first case is they lose the first case on appeal. They've got a conviction. They lose on appeal. And the change of trial strategy is to move to their second best strategy. The first best turned out to be unworkable or unlawful.
Well, Your Honor, again,
doesn't mean vindictiveness. That's just
I don't know that you have to go to a per se rule on this, but in this particular case, all the government is doing is going to responding to our very same strategy that it knew pre-trial before the first trial. that they knew in the first trial that we were going to present literal defense as literal truth as a defense. All this court did was confirm that we could. It would be a different case, Judge Ginsburg, if the government sought to put on a particular witness in the first trial, and this court said, no, you can't put on that witness. There, you could see how a change of strategy might result from this court's opinion. But here, this court's opinion only confirmed what was going on at the first trial. If I may briefly turn to the...
This is about the expert testimony or not? The point you're just making, are you talking about the expert testimony?
Yes, that's right, because we had told the government pre-trial in May of 2006 that we planned to put on an expert. If they thought it necessary to adapt a trial strategy which required charging rather than simply putting in evidence regarding the FBI's statement, the statements to the FBI, they certainly could have done so at that time. Indeed, Judge Friedman, at the very conference that we told the government that we intended to put on an expert witness in early May of 2006, Judge Friedman at that very point said, well, the government can file a superseding right now if it wants to. It's not too late to do so. So this trial strategy justification really looks a lot like a post hoc rationalization for bringing extra charges. Under the burden shifting analysis of Blackledge, we think we have rebutted the government showing by showing that their justifications are entirely pretextual. Your Honor, my red light is on. I'd like to address the charter flight issue, but I defer to you.
Sorry, what issue?
The issue of the evidence of the charter flight.
Yes, go ahead. Take a couple of minutes.
Okay. Your Honor, our argument there, our position there is that admission of the $91,000 cost of the charter flight was both irrelevant and highly unfairly prejudicial. So it was erroneous under both Rule 401 and 403 to admit the evidence. As far as the unfair prejudice, it was the 10-ton gorilla in the room, Your Honor. Given that Mr. Safavian only paid $3,100 for the trip, and the gift rules only have a $250 cushion, you're talking about $3,500 there. The pro rata share of the trip was the charter flight would have been $11,000. At that point, all the jury has to do is accept that in order to convict. It meets the definition of unfair prejudice, but it's also irrelevant. It's irrelevant because it's not supported by the law in this case. Ultimately, what the district court did was submit all of this evidence to the jury without any direction as to how to apply it, as to how to apply any of the legal rules at issue, and said it's a factual issue for the jury to decide. But
the jury had the benefit of various possible ways of approaching this, right?
It did, Your Honor, but...
And they were told, well, we'll have to decide which is the correct approach.
Right, but that's I respectfully submit, Your Honor, is a legal determination. It's not a factual determination for a jury to make. It's an interpretation of a governing regulation, the market value regulation in the CFRs. And Your Honor,
the question, what is the market value of something, is a question of fact, right?
Well, I don't think so. I think it's in this particular. There is
the ultimate question. Well, if I ask you what's the value of an eggplant, it will clearly be a question of fact.
Well, the standard to apply in determining market value, Your Honor, the standard to apply in determining market value is a question of law. And here there was a regulation that was applicable. An employee who cannot ascertain the market value of a gift may estimate its market value by reference to the retail cost of similar items of like quality. Now, we submit that the rule of lenity has to apply in this context because there's a criminal conviction hinging on the interpretation of that regulation. It can't be that you choose the highest value, which would be, in this case, the pro rata share of the charter flight. It can't be that. The other reasonable interpretation, and an interpretation that we've offered and applies in many other contexts, is the commercial equivalent fare.
Why didn't you just say the incremental cost of carrying his weight in his baggage?
Well, Your Honor, that certainly could be. That in a case like this where there is no,
there's no uniquely correct point in, between or including the incremental cost of the fuel for carrying his weight and the fraction of the total cost, the 1/8 or 1/9 attributable to him.
But in putting in that the evidence at the high end, what you've done is the district court has done is allowed the jury to find him criminally liable for failing to meet the highest standard, the most expensive standard.
Well, I mean, another way to look at it is that is just among the things the jury is to consider. The total cost is 91. There's a contest as to whether or not he was telling the truth when he said he reimbursed Abramov when he gave him 3,100. And among the things that you would, among the things you would look at is the total cost of the trip is 91. And it seems to me the counter is, yeah, that's a total cost, but it is not conclusive. It doesn't automatically follow that he's chargeable on a pro rata. But you have to have a starting point, don't you?
Well, you
certainly can't say it's irrelevant.
Well, I think you can, Your Honor, because you have to, in considering our objection, you have to consider also the legal standard which would apply here. And you can't interpret that regulation under the rule of lenity in any other way than to say.
Did you seek an instruction?
Your Honor, our instruction, the government sought no instruction whatsoever. The market value, the instruction we sought said that the government doesn't have a standard, that the GSA has no standard. And that's certainly true, but that doesn't mean that.
That came in.
Yes, that did come in.
Well, I mean, if what you're saying now is what you believe, why wouldn't you have sought an instruction that said there was no obligation to pay a proposed
share? At the point that we objected, it was well before. I mean, the court ruled before the instructions that this would come
matter.
In.
The court may allow the 91 in, but that doesn't explain why you didn't ask for an instruction.
Well, ideally,
as a matter of law, he was not obliged to pay pro rata share of the total cost of the flight, and then the jury would have had that clearly in its head. Yeah, it's 91,000, but as they explained to us in the instruction and in closing argument. That 91 is, don't get confused by it, because he's not required to pay a percentage of that.
Your Honor, ideally that instruction would have come in, but the point is that the same ruling underscores the ruling on relevance and 403. So.
No, you're not answering my question. I'm not understanding why you didn't seek the instruction.
Your Honor, the answer is I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Sangeeta Rao with the Criminal Appellate Section at the Department of Justice representing the United States. Turning to the vindictive prosecution claim, to succeed here, defendant has to meet the high hurdle of proving that the district court abused its discretion when it found that counts 3 and 5 were justified by new evidence and trial strategy. He can't do that. Indeed, he cites not a single case in which a court of appeals has reversed a district court's finding of no vindictiveness.
Well, a point would be a first.
Your Honor, we don't believe
I don't get it on count 5 for starters. I mean, that it's a bogus suggestion that evidence couldn't have come in unless you try. It's just ridiculous. That there's no, I mean, maybe someone in the criminal division thought it, but that can't be the basis.
Your Honor, the district court, having seen the trial, having seen what kinds of objections.
Yeah, we're on appeal now, so district court judges make mistakes on the law. But there's nothing in the law that would have foreclosed that FBI testimony. That just seems silly to me. And that's the only justification you offer. That's utterly ridiculous.
Well, of course, district courts do make mistakes all the time. It would be reasonable for the government to reduce any or to eliminate any litigation risk of the district court mistakenly excluding that evidence by charging the statements. There's another reason to charge the statements as well, and that is that those statements lie, they don't just undermine the literal truth defense. They actually lie outside the literal truth defense. The defendant was arguing that when he said Abramov has no business before the agency, that he had this technical definition in mind. But when he's talking to the FBI, he doesn't use those terms. He doesn't use the terms doing business, and he doesn't use the terms that Abramoff had no business. So the government had a good reason to refocus the trial away from statements that used that term.
No matter how you state it, it seems inconceivable to me that you could not have put in the testimony. Did the district court say the testimony would be barred unless you added a new count?
No.
Of course not. I doubt very seriously that had the trial judge been asked that question, the trial judge would have said, yeah, I'll exclude it, because it's not excludable.
And then the government
in
other
reasonable terms, it's not excludable.
And the government in cases like Poole and Campbell also believe that certain evidence about uncharged transactions was not excludable. But I think in one of those cases, the district court had excluded it or was talking about excluding it. So the government makes these determinations, and it's unsure of exactly what the district court's going to do.
The district court did not say he was going to exclude it. The law does not in any way suggest that it's excludable, and it looks vindictive.
It would still be reasonable for the government to eliminate litigation risk.
No, it's not reasonable merely because an attorney in your office says, well, I don't know, this seems reasonable to me, when the law is quite the contrary and the trial judge has said nothing to suggest otherwise.
Even if this court were to find that portion clearly erroneous, that doesn't speak to the other justification we offer, which is that these statements actually lay outside the literal truth defense, so that to the extent that the government, that false statements about Abramoff doing business with GSA were going to be vulnerable because of the literal truth defense, these statements weren't. These statements, the FBI didn't use those terms, and so they were justified on that
about
basis.
Count three. Did we on the obstruction on the original appeal, didn't we uphold it?
This court did uphold it. Of course, the government doesn't make decisions about whether to bring charges based on whether it thinks it can survive a sufficiency challenge. It makes a decision on whether it has a good amount of evidence, sufficient to convince a jury and not just survive a sufficiency challenge. You can see that the government didn't believe that it had enough evidence to proceed on a false statement charge at the time of the first indictment because of the way the government phrased the first indictment. The count one, which charged obstruction of the investigation, only said that the defendant stated that he had paid his full cost. It didn't say that he had falsely stated. And the government represented to the district court that it believed that in order to go forward on a true false statement charge about the cost, it needed to prove the cost of the trip. And until it got Laura Van Zyl's testimony about how much the Scottish portion of the trip cost, it couldn't prove the cost of the trip. Now, the documents were coming in on a rolling basis, and they were coming in post-indictment and pretrial, and by the time the government got to trial, it might have had even more information, but that doesn't mean at the time it had to make the decision about the first indictment that it had that information. Another critical piece of evidence was Will Heaton's testimony. He was unavailable at the first trial. He was asserting the Fifth Amendment. His testimony was critical because he was much more credible than Neil Volz, who testified at the first trial, and he was one of the lobbyists. The district court compared the credibility of Will Heaton to a choir boy and of Neil Volz to a sleazebag. That's a huge credibility determination. And there are cases where the prosecutor's evaluation of a witness's credibility is considered an objective reason sufficient to rebut a presumption. Williams versus Bartow, cited by the defendants, is one of those cases. And I believe that Campbell is another of those cases, and we cite it in our brief. Will Heaton's testimony was critical because he was in the same position as Safavian. He was a trip participant, not a lobbyist, who never saw any bills or invoices, yet he knew, given the swankiness of the golf resort, the meals, the cigars, the beer, the scotch, that the trip was valued at far over $3,200. He also said that he knew that his transportation costs were far over $1,500 because of the luxuriousness of the charter jet, which ferried them from place to place and waited for them on the tarmac as they were playing golf in order to take them to London at their beck and call.
Is there any evidence that the government believed ex ante that Heaton's testimony would be more credible?
That they believed prior to the, I'm not sure I understand Your Honor's question.
They believe ex ante, is there anything to suggest ex ante that they believe his testimony would be more credible?
There's no evidence in the record other than the district court found it as well, that that was a legitimate consideration, that Will Heaton, he was more credible. And aside from that, just the corroboration of a second witness would be powerful evidence. At the first trial, you simply had Neil Volz testifying about the swankiness of the trip. Regardless of just the, if the court considers it a subjective credibility determination, two witnesses corroborating each other on how much was paid and that the government officials weren't paying any of the bills would be powerful testimony about the cost of the trip and defendant's reasonable belief about the cost of the trip.
I thought the Scottish witness simply wasn't available at the first trial.
That's right. The Scottish witness and many of the documents that she was introducing were being secured through the MLAP process, and that process simply hadn't been completed by the first trial.
What about Heaton?
He was unavailable because he was asserting the Fifth Amendment at the first trial.
So you had two objective
reasons
here.
As the district court found. I mean, that's what the district court relied on, that they were unavailable and that those were important considerations in proving.
You go back a second. When did you learn about the expert that the defense would put on?
12 days before trial or 14 days before trial? We give the number in the brief. I think it was 4 days before the pretrial conference.
Before the pretrial conference. Okay.
4 days before the pretrial conference, and I think it's 12 days before trial. But it is, the numbers are mentioned in our brief. The district court found that the government was reacting to evidence that it didn't know about, the literal truth defense, or at least evidence that it didn't know was going to be bolstered by expert testimony, and so that was a reasonable justification to add, as a trial strategy matter, the count five statements. If I
understand you, you did know before the first trial.
We knew, yes, 12 days roughly.
Did you think the expert testimony, why would you think the expert testimony would be excluded?
It was excluded at the first trial.
I know, but, you know, that's what actually happened. But what reason would you have for thinking it would be?
The government's argument is that Sabhabian actually didn't use the technical term doing business. He said Abramoff has no business before GSA. We argued that, and he used the words work, that Abramoff does all his work on Capitol Hill. We argued and believed that those were just common sense words that should be taken in their common sense definition, and the jury was perfectly qualified to decide what they meant without any other. Turning to the evidence of the cost of the charter flight, it's critical to realize that the only claim properly before this court is a challenge to the admission of that evidence under Rules 401 and 403. In his opening brief to this court, defendant only claimed evidentiary error. So under Van Smith, which we cited in our brief, any other claims are waived. Below, defendant's objection.
What's the distinction you're drawing between evidentiary error and 401, 403?
Yeah, I was going to ask the same thing.
No, I'm not making a distinction between 401 and 403. I'm saying that those are the evidentiary objections he made.
Right.
Before this
right.
court, he seems to be trying to make an instructional error.
Oh. Well, I think that's
no,
only,
that was
he was more, answering a question about the instructions.
I think that in their reply brief, when they say that this was not a jury question, this was a legal determination, that is an argument that the district court should have interpreted the ethics regulation. And
Well, don't you have to make a request for an instruction?
Yes, and so
I don't think he's making that argument. I asked him at the end, he honestly said, I don't know why it wasn't. So
and
I don't think that's not the thrust of their argument.
If it is simply an evidentiary objection, it fails utterly. They certainly don't overcome, again, a high hurdle that they need to surmount in order to find an abuse of discretion in a district court's evidentiary rulings. And certainly this evidence was relevant. It was relevant to proving the cost of the trip, which would prove the falsity of the statement, and to the defendant's perception of the cost.
It might nonetheless have been unduly prejudicial.
As the district court found, again, that would be an abuse of discretion standard. It was not overly prejudicial, given, first, the testimony from many people that there were other ways to value the trip, the testimony, the closing argument of both the defendant and the government that acknowledged there were different ways to value the trip. There was the $758 cost of Heaton's one-way trip home, which is Government Exhibit 12. There's the $1,000 cost of his round-trip ticket to Scotland when he was a chaperone a few years earlier. There are a number of other measures other than $11,000 that were before the court. And the government...
But that only bolsters the case that there was no need to incur the prejudice associated with introducing the $90,000 and $11,000 figures.
But it was relevant. It was relevant circumstantial evidence of how luxurious... Even with prejudice, there was no request for a limiting instruction on the use of the evidence. Those would all go into the prejudice inquiry, and defendants simply didn't make those arguments below. And if you look at the entire record, the jury had plenty of evidence.
What kind of instruction would have blunted the prejudice of the $90,000?
Well, the district court could have said, you can consider this only in relation to defendant's knowledge about the luxuriousness of the trip, but not as evidence of whether defendant reasonably should have paid that amount.
So don't think about the elephant in the room. It's pretty difficult. No, that's a very fine line you're drawing.
The instruction would have been consider it for the luxuriousness, and it's completely legitimate to consider it for the luxuriousness. Charter flight travel is different than even a first class ticket, but the district court could have given an instruction that there are many other ways to interpret it out there, and so...
That thing, the jury got that, right?
Which is why it wasn't prejudicial, Your Honor.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you, Ms. Rao.
Thank
you. 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Edwards, on the trial strategy point, the district court actually said it wasn't excludable. He ruled that said that the evidence that the government is saying we needed to charge in order to make sure it got into the record, he actually said that evidence was not excludable. He said it should come in, and he wouldn't have excluded it. The district court actually said that in a hearing in this case.
Couldn't have excluded it.
That's right.
But he would have gotten reversed.
Your Honor, it came in the first trial without objection. On the new evidence point, the point about Heaton being similarly situated, actually Heaton knew all along that the entire purpose of the trip was bogus. He was a congressional staffer who said that he was taking an official business trip, which wasn't official business at all. So he wasn't similarly situated at all.
What's the point of that?
Well, I'm simply rebutting the government's argument that this evidence was somehow so overpowering that it had to come in, notwithstanding the fact that they already had enough evidence to convict on this misstatement. There's nothing. My point is, there's nothing new and overpowering about this evidence, which gives the government a justification to bring charges. Remember, Judge Ginsburg.
The question about the new evidence is not whether they had enough before, is it? It's whether objectively this was reasonable and relevant.
I think, Your Honor, it is. I think that is exactly the question.
New evidence is not a new count.
They brought a new. Let me break this down because this is really important. They brought a new count.
Yeah.
Lying on the SF-278 ethics disclosure form.
Right.
And the reason they brought that new count, they say, is we had new evidence. The misstatement on that SF-278 form was about the value of the trip. It was, he should have reported anything over $3,300.
The new evidence is that now Heaton's available.
The new evidence is that Heaton and Van Zyl were available. But the point is, the government already knew enough to charge on that very misstatement, and they did in the first trial. Count one of the first trial was obstruction based on the misstatement that he had paid the entire cost of the trip. So the government had made pre-trial, before the first trial, the government had made a determination that it had enough evidence to charge David Safavian with the misstatement about the value of the trip. It also had the SF-278 at that point. It came in evidence at the first trial. So they had everything they needed to charge on that count before the first trial. And this court, in its prior opinion, said it was enough to convict. Now, our point is simply that once that judgment has been made pre-trial in the first trial, the government could come up with some new witness to say something new.
Their answer is that the new charge is different from the charge that accompanied the obstruction.
Their only answer is it's different in the sense we didn't use the word false in the indictment. But everything they did at trial and this court's opinion in the prior case assumed that the only reason there would be obstruction there is the falseness of the statement. That was their entire trial theory. And in fact, Your Honor, the closing statement of the trial counsel for the government in the first trial was all designed, it's in our supplemental appendix, it was all designed to show that the real cost of the trip was between $7,000 and $17,000. That was the government's theory at the first trial. Their theory at the second trial was that the cost of the trip was $7,000 to $17,000.
If you get a reversal on less than the whole in this case, is there any reason to remand?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, it's within this court's power to throw out the entire superseding indictment. Meyer says that. It may be an extreme remedy, but it certainly is a remedy within the authority of this court. Secondly, there would need to be resentencing in this case. The sentencing range that the district court found was between 15 and 18 months, and he gave 12 months and a day. So he exercised his discretion.
It's concurrent and all.
Yeah, he exercised his discretion, however, for a downward departure. The range would be different here, and I think the district court needs the opportunity to determine whether or not the same sentence should apply or another departure should apply. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Case is submitted.